We got into the minibus one morning and we drove up to an area towards the mountain. Air became cooler, and at first we passed houses, which multi-storied houses, beautiful houses. And then as the road wound up the mountain and then took a turn and we went downhill, all of a sudden there was this area which by all international standards you could see here is where poor people live. Little corner shop, little workshop next door. The road's paved, but you can see fairly well worn. And then we entered an area where there were revolutionary guards, and they didn't bother to search us. They just made certain we didn't have any weapons on us. And in we went. The guide took us into a little alley, and then all of a sudden, there was it couldn't be even called a cottage. It was the frontage of a house, which I marked off with my feet. I'm an architectural student by training, just to estimate what the length of the building was. And this room, which had a glass front, obviously the glass front had been put there to get people to observe this place without disturbing the contents inside, was the reception area of the house in which Imam Khomeini had lived before he had was forced into exile for 14 years. And when he came back, became head of the revolution, he went back to the same house from where he had been exiled. The room measured 3 meters by 4.5 meters. In the old English language, that would be 15 feet by 10 feet. And in the space was a couch about 2 meters long, along the wall, and next to that, a coffee table about a meter by a meter square. The floor was carpeted, and then a curtain covered the back wall, which led to sleeping quarters, which we couldn't see into. There were 4 shelves, a circular mirror at the back of the couch, and a light, electric light, dangling over the couch. There were 2 little stools which looked like footstools, and later on I realized, looking at photographs of Imam Khomeini's life, that these were in fact little tables which he used to write on and place his Quran on when reading. This was the house in which the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, may Allah be pleased with him, received leaders like the head of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev. And somebody came up to me and whispered that when Gorbachev sat there in front of Imam Khomeini, he was actually shivering. Because here was a person who commanded the respect of a nation of 60 million people. The day he arrived at Tehran airport, in exile from, he was in exile in France, and when the plane landed, there were 6 million people waiting to greet him. And if you look at the video, you realize that it was impossible for this car to move in that crowd. Everybody wanted to have a look at him or touch him or shake his hands. And the guards on duty had their hands full. I believe that Imam Khomeini went directly from the airport to the Beheshti Zahra, the cemetery where all the martyrs are buried. And it took so long for this crowd to accompany Imam Khomeini to the Beheshti Zahra that the car in which he was driving, the engine burnt out. It was moving so slowly. So they had to bring a helicopter in order to get Imam Khomeini to the destination. Standing there, one reflects that a person who lived under these humble conditions, and there's no other word to describe it, the simplicity in capital letters reflecting the lifestyle of this great leader, of whom certain qualities have been ascribed to, which are not found in other human beings. Then, from the house level itself, there's a little raised platform with metal supports and covered with a bit of carpeting, and this leads into what is known as the Imam's Masjid. The area in which this is located, I think, is called Jamarand. So we came out of this little area still trying to digest why a great leader like this would go back to his humble abode when he was now the leader of this revolution and could have chosen any of the Shah, the monarch's palaces that have been built. Now, the Shah's palaces have things like gold taps and chandeliers, etc. And coming out of there, we immediately struck again by the mosque from which Imam Khomeini used to deliver his messages. And as we got there, we noticed that the masjid was filled with revolutionary guards, all in their uniforms, and they were listening attentively to a Hujjatul Islam delivering a talk in Farsi. Before I come back to the masjid, which was filled with revolutionary guards, and some were even in the entrance to the masjid, so crowded it was, I just have to mention that later on we discovered that this house in which Imam Khomeini and his wife lived before and after he came back from exile was actually a rented house. He didn't own this house. We were then politely ushered into the masjid, and then we couldn't resist just sitting down right there next to the revolutionary guards, because this atmosphere was too captivating. And then there's this raised platform about 2 meters from the ground, like a little balcony, and this enormous chair covered in a white cloth. Now, I've seen this before on videotapes, because that's the chair Imam Khomeini used to sit in and address crowds of visitors who used to come. And then I recall one incident from a person who came from Canada. His name is Robertson. And a brother of ours, Brother Abdullah Didat, a friend of mine from Johannesburg, when I related to him the story about Robertson that I'd read in a book, he said that on that particular day that Robertson is describing, he was present there in that masjid. Now, what Robertson writes is, he says that he is not a believer, he's an agnostic. And he was sitting in that masjid waiting for the Imam to come out to address this group of tourists. And he says, these are his words, before the Imam entered the room, there was a hurricane of energy which preceded him. Close quotes. And he said, the Imam came in and sat there, greeted them and spoke to them. And Abdullah then says to me that when everybody got up to leave after the Imam had gone back to his room, Robertson was still sitting there on the floor of the masjid, staring at the chair. And Abdullah said to him, come, let's go. And he said, no, he is still sitting there. Now, Robertson in his book writes that later on they were given the opportunity to go and ask questions outside the masjid. And Abdullah Dida then had said to him, you are an agnostic, now's your chance to ask the questions. And Robertson writes in his book that I know that I'm not going to embrace Islam, but I swear on that day I met a man of God. Now that to me is absolutely astounding, that a person who has the first time contact with this enormous personality, enormous in a sense, of this aura that pervaded him, that surrounded him, that even an agnostic would feel that. Now, how do we think other people who are more sincere and are committed to Islam? Would actually relate to that. The Imam, the Hujjatul Islam, completed his talk, and then the Revolutionary Guard commander then took over and started reading some of the poetry that Imam Khomeini had written. And this poetry is all highly mystical stuff, because this was the dimension in which Imam Khomeini grew and which the majority of humanity on earth never even dream of reaching. After that, there were takbirs, the salawat, and then of course the revolutionary slogans again. Now these revolutionary guards were the ones that Imam Khomeini instructed should be created as soon as the revolution had succeeded. And in fact, they were in place a couple of days after the revolution. To defend the gains of the revolution, these youth had to be trained. If it was possible, I would have sat there, and I don't know when I would have got up. But then I realized the driver was waiting outside, and the brothers from Iran were with me, possibly because they go there so often. They realized that they also had other things to do. But for me, the most important thing was to digest what in fact was transpiring here, almost, shall we say, 11 plus 3, 14 years later, when the presence of this personality physically is no longer there, and yet he is still there. And Imam Khomeini had instructed them that that little area in which he grew up must not be renovated. His house in which he had lived, the rented house, should not be touched, and the masjid where he had officiated, they should not even re-carpet or tile the place. This was an indication that he knew that he had chosen to live there to indicate to his own people and to the world that these are the qualities of a leader which we learned from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and which had been followed by Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam's son-in-law Imam Ali and the subsequent leaders of this glorious revolutionary trend. There was a Marxist at the conference on Palestine, and I said to him unashamedly, "At last I have found a socialist who lived his socialist ideas." This person is a Marxist, so he understood exactly what I meant. We came out there and we thought, well, now we've seen everything. And somebody indicated to us, there is a museum next door. Going down some steps, here was a space, not very big, but rich in its presentation. It would stimulate you intellectually, stimulate you emotionally, and stimulate you spiritually. And I'm referring here to walls and walls of photographs enlarged of Imam Khomeini, the place where his father was born, and then as a youth how he grew up, where he learned, sitting with his professors, and then of course growing in stature, and you have this visual display. And to crown it all, he was a middle-aged man with a cap on his head, smile on his face, bespectacled, and he saw that we were definitely not Iranians. And this was the curator of the museum. He immediately came up to us, greeted in Arabic, and then when I asked my first question, he immediately went into top gear in explaining in English what the display was about. And I could see he was annoyed at times when the driver indicated to him that we had some other business to do as well. And I was glad that he ignored the driver. Because here I was standing with a person, obviously, who loved every word that he was saying about this imam. And I couldn't hesitate to ask him, "Did you ever meet the imam personally?" And he said, "Unfortunately, no. I saw him at a distance, and I've heard and read about him, but I was never personally in his company to say I was in face-to-face contact with him." And then we went to see some of the displays. Now, there's a saying in journalism, a picture tells a million stories. Now, in this particular case, it was true. The display cabinets, which were sealed, had examples of Imam Khomeini's writings, his lectures, his letters, some of his possessions, the waistcoat that he wore, the sandals that he wore, his spectacles, and there was the will that he made out. And this will was translated in English on the display. Actually reads that the land which he had inherited from his father, agricultural and residential property, must be sold and all the proceeds must be given to the poor. And then the letters that he wrote to Gorbachev and to the Pope. And then there were envelopes. You could see that they had become discolored because of the age already. But there were hundreds of these envelopes with letters in them, some folded, some opened. And then the curator told us that, and he showed us a little diary where Imam Khomeini had entered every letter that he had received and every letter that he had replied to. He had kept this inventory. And he said that Imam Khomeini, during his lifetime, had received, and these letters are all recorded in there, over 1 million letters from people inside Iran and 200,000 letters from people outside Iran. Now, I write a lot and read a lot and receive letters, but I've never seen anything as remarkable as this, where one person would actually record his own post received and post sent out. He didn't employ a secretary. Those were his private letters which he had received, and he acknowledged it. Now, your respect for other human beings is reflected in this particular attitude. There's so many other things that struck us because of the photographs, the death of his son in exile, Sayyid Mustafa, who was poisoned by the CIA. And the curator told us that Imam Khomeini was busy giving a lecture when somebody came into the room and said they want to tell him something, whispered in his ear, and told him that his son had just been died of poisoning. And Imam Khomeini continued teaching without shedding a tear. And then, after he had finished, he then went to attend to the business of the janazah. Now, this is totally unusual. I've never come across any person so dedicated to the work that he was doing and to retain such emotional control under those circumstances. The scene in hospital where he is performing, of all things, tahajjud salah whilst he was being treated for a heart ailment and had the intravenous drips in his arms. I specifically saw this on video around about 1990. But here, this person was narrating this to me looking at the photograph. And he said that Imam Khomeini was not aware that they had a hidden camera taking all these scenes, you know, of his last moment in hospital. I recall his last words when he was on his deathbed, and he said, "Oh Allah, may I be acceptable unto you." Now here is a person that has spent his entire life in learning and teaching Islam and upholding the principles of Islam, and this is the dua that he makes at the end of it. Now what about us poor mortals who treat Islam in such a haphazard fashion that we do things when we are reminded that we should do them, who are neglectful, who sometimes do shameful things in the name of Islam. But here, Imam Khomeini asks that he may be acceptable unto Allah. The amazing thing also, the curator tells us, that Imam Khomeini had performed tahajjud salah for 70 years of his life uninterruptedly. He didn't miss it for a single night. And when he was in exile in Najaf, he went to visit the qabr of Imam Ali. Every single day for all the years that he was in Najaf. Every single day. Now, I just want to ask listeners and readers, how many times have you been to your loved one's grave? Perhaps once a year, initially, and later on you don't bother to go for decades. Now, obviously, this link between life and death was a crucial factor in the development of Imam's spiritual development. From there, we took this long drive to the Beheshti Zahra Cemetery. And we were still trying to digest what we had seen at this humble residence, then this humble mosque, and this wealth of information in the museum. And as we approached the Beheshti Zahra Cemetery, I turned to a friend of mine and I said to him, "You know, when I go back to South Africa, and if you accompanied me, I'd be ashamed to take you with me to one of our qabrstans, to one of our cemeteries. Because they are neglected, right? There's no decent pathways, it's overgrown with shrubs. Basically, it's a place where we dump dead bodies, except for the fortunate few who, you know, whose families actually go there and maintain it and put flowers on it, etc. But as you approach the Beheshti Zahra, the first impression that this is an enormous series of masajid that are standing there, and then as you enter the gates, you realize that this is in fact the shrines built here around these karamat of these saints. I've got no doubt in my mind that Imam Khomeini was a saint. Absolutely no doubt. His entire lifestyle indicated that. Whilst we were at the house of Imam Khomeini, an elderly person walked up to me, Iranian. I didn't know him, he didn't know me. And the first thing he said to me after I greeted him, and if Iranian translated for me, he said, "Imam Khomeini did not like money." And I stood there and was quite amazed that this is the first thing that this elderly citizen was telling me. And he said, "Imam Khomeini loved the poor and he was pious." I found that very interesting. Now, who had sent this man to me to tell me this? He's not a tourist guide. So then I asked him for his name, and he said that his name is Brother Mirani. And I hope, inshallah, one day I will meet him again. And then I asked him, did you ever meet Imam Khomeini personally, and shook his hand? He said, no. I've seen him on television and I've heard about him. But on that particular day, he had come to pay his respects on the anniversary of the revolution. And he says, I never met him, but he is still alive today. He said, Imam Khomeini is still alive. And we, the Muslims of Iran, will continue in his way. Now, that to me is the message of the revolution. That here was a trustworthy leader. Here was a leader that could be respected. Here was a leader who didn't say, do as I tell you to do, but don't do as I do. If we did what Imam Khomeini did, the world wouldn't have a single oppressor in it. The brother's name, who's the curator of the museum, his name is Brother Hussein Nikufau. I'm mentioning this name in case somebody out there has the enthusiasm to pay a visit and go and speak to this brother. You will not be disappointed. This is a walking encyclopedia of the biography of Imam Khomeini. At the Beheshti Zahra, we entered this enormous complex. And when I say enormous, it really is enormous. These beautiful domes and the minarets, as they say in English, the floor tiled, the entire complex air conditioned. It's freezing cold outside, and you walk into this warm atmosphere. And here were groups of women and children and men performing salah, making dua, sitting there making tasbih, all in this spiritual atmosphere which was unbelievable. And in the center of it, under the dome, here is the qabr of Imam Khomeini, and next to him his son Ahmed, who had also died very young. And it is screened off with a metal screen so that obviously that people would not go near it, because we saw that at the burial of Imam Khomeini that it was difficult to put the mayat, to put the body into the ground. People wanted to touch it. They wanted to tear off a piece of the kafan, of the burial shroud. And the same would happen if that Kabristan was not protected. Inside the Kabristan, which is also got glass on the inside of the metal frame, there were hundreds of thousands of riyals lying. And I couldn't make sense of this. And then another person inquired, what is the money doing inside this enclosure? And then we discovered that people who come there, they donate this money to the poor and to the needy. And obviously, they put it through there and not at some other place, hoping that this sadaqah and zakah and whatever else they give will be more acceptable to Allah if it is done in that particular place. I personally can't see anything wrong with that attitude, because people still acknowledge that even in his death, he has this aura of sanctity hanging around him, and what he taught people is still remembered by them. And I'm sure it doesn't matter what any Westerner says, or atheist says, or agnostic says, or Sunni says, that this is going to be what the people will be doing for the rest of their lives. The same Beheshti Zahra, of course, contains the graves of people like Ayatollah Beheshti, Ayatollah Talegani, the former prime minister and president was assassinated, Muhammad Ali Rajai, and the 72 Islamic Republican Party members who were assassinated. And of course, we have the hundreds of thousands of Iranians who were killed during the revolution, and of course, in the imposed war that they fought against Iraq. We left there as evening was setting, deep in thought. And one of the young brothers who had accompanied us turned to us and narrated certain incidents in Imam's life. And then we asked him, "But how old are you?" Because he looked fairly young. And he said, "Well, he's 25 years old." The other brother was just about 30 years old. And then we asked him, "But how do you remember these things?" So he said he was 7 years old when Imam Khomeini had given him a piece of chocolate. And he remembers this. And years later now, as a person going into his 30s, he now realizes the great significance of this little act by Imam Khomeini, his love for children, etc. In summary, I wanted to know who was close to Imam Khomeini and who would have known him in such a way as no other people would have known him. And then, of all things, I walk into the conference, and here was Imam Khomeini's daughter sitting. A dignified woman in full hijab. And then when they introduced her, I discovered that she was a professor of philosophy. And moreover, she was active in the organization which was fighting to establish the rights of the Palestinian people. She had just gone through one revolution with her father, with all the drama, the traumatic incidents, the 8-year war. And here, the next step of her life is devoted now to bringing about this revolutionary change in occupied Palestine. And the one thing that she said just stuck me. She says, "I've acquired all this knowledge and other things, but the one thing you can't take away from me is that Imam Khomeini was my father." Now, this is a tribute from a daughter to her father. Now, I wondered if that was the same, and I'm sure it was the same thing, that Sayyidatunisa Fatima said about her father, Rasulullah. "This one thing you can't take away from me is that my father is Nabi Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam." Then, just another coincidence. Remember, this is my first trip to Iran. I'm invited to a supper, and the host had also invited an Ayatollah who had been the personal assistant of Imam Khomeini. And he had known Imam Khomeini intimately for 25 years, in exile as well as on the return from exile inside Iran. Quite an imposing figure, spoke fluently in Arabic and Persian. And then there was a break for supper. And while everybody else went to eat, I took my plate of food and made my way back to the room where this Ayatollah was sitting. And then I plucked up enough courage to ask Sheikh Muhammad Al-Asi to act as the interpreter for the simple reason that I didn't want to be misunderstood. And Sheikh Khalasi agreed. So I asked the Ayatollah the following question. Tell me three things about Imam Khomeini that you deem to be the most significant in his life. He thought for about 10 seconds and then he said, well, the first thing was his complete faith in Allah, his complete taqwa, that nothing stood between him and Allah. And if he wanted to do something, he put his full trust in Allah. The second thing he said was the depth of his knowledge. He says there are two schools of philosophy in which Imam Khomeini was thoroughly versed, and the school of thought of Ibn al-Arabi was his forte. And he said Imam Khomeini had an opinion on anything and everything you could ask him about it. And then he said the third thing was this unshakable courage that he had. And he said that you can find two of these three things in any other human being. But when these three things exist within one individual, you have got a unique individual. And this was the case of Imam Khomeini. I then asked the second question, and that is, give me one example where this last point that you mentioned, his fearlessness, was demonstrated. And then he mentioned the incident where he was warned by the intelligence of the revolution that they had located his residence. Now, obviously, the Americans must have used satellite communication to actually pinpoint the residence of Imam Khomeini. And the information was that it was going to be bombed, and in the process, about 1,000 other people were going to lose their lives. And they asked Imam Khomeini to vacate his house. And his reply was that if the people's life is in danger, then I stay with them and I'm not going to move. And he refused. And of course, the place was not bombed. And he said, there's nothing the Americans can do. Now, with that type of leadership, one can expect results which to other people would be impossible to attain. And verily, this is what happened. And I'm actually saddened by the fact that Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Tutu, and others referred to the South African transition as a miracle. If somebody told me the transition in Iran was a miracle, then I would say yes, that truly was a miracle, with such leadership and such results. Because the results of a revolution here in Iran and the results of the sellout in South Africa are completely the opposite in terms of social, political, and economic realities, and in terms of political morality. I'm glad and proud to be here on the 24th anniversary of this revolution, and I think certainly the world is safe, has a future, if Iran is safe and Iran has a future. And if we say, is there a necessity for Islamic revolution, I would simply ask the question, is truth necessary? And if truth is necessary, then Islamic revolution is absolutely necessary. Shukran.